Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. For those of you who may not be aware, September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and I'd like to start off with some information from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Suicidal thoughts, much like mental health conditions, can affect anyone regardless of age, gender, or background. In fact, suicide is often the result of an untreated mental health condition. Suicidal thoughts, although common, should not be considered normal and often indicate more serious issues. Every year, thousands of individuals die by suicide, leaving behind their friends and family members to navigate the tragedy of loss. In many cases, friends and families affected by a suicide loss, often called suicide loss survivors, are left in the dark. Too often, the feelings of shame and stigma prevent them from talking openly. September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, a time to share resources and stories in an effort to shed light on this highly taboo and stigmatized topic. For those of you who may be in crisis or know someone in crisis, or are experiencing difficult or suicidal thoughts, you can call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. If you're uncomfortable talking on the phone, you can also text NAMI to 741-741 to be connected to a free trained crisis counselor on the crisis text line. Okay, sticking to the theme of preventing suicide, this from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Several factors can increase the risk for suicide and protect against it. Suicide is connected to other forms of injury and violence and causes serious health and economic consequences. For example, suicide risk is higher among people who have experienced violence, including child abuse, bullying, or sexual violence. Protective factors like family and community support or connectedness and easy access to healthcare can help decrease the risk for suicidal thoughts and behavior. Suicide is a large and growing public health problem. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. It is responsible for more than 47,000 deaths in 2017, resulting in about one death every 11 minutes. Every year, many more people think about or attempt suicide than die by suicide. In 2017, 10.6 million American adults seriously thought about suicide, 3.2 million made a plan, and 1.4 million attempted suicide. Okay, I just wanted to stop for a moment, kind of take a look at those numbers. With 47,000 deaths, that's as part of 1.4 million attempted suicides. So there you have it, about one out of 30 attempts results in a suicide death. And then there's 3.2 million people who made a plan for suicide and 1.4 million attempted suicide. So about half of those people that make a plan actually attempt the suicide. And then you have 10.6 million American adults who seriously thought about suicide, and then about a third of those actually make a plan. So there's a lot more people who are affected or are contemplating suicide relative to even the many 47,000 deaths that occur each year in the U.S. Okay, suicide affects all ages. Suicide is a problem throughout the lifespan. It is the second leading cause of death for people 10 to 34 years of age, the fourth leading cause of death among people ages 35 to 54, and the eighth leading cause of death among people 55 to 64. In addition to the number of people who are injured or die, suicide also affects the health of others and the community. When people die by suicide, their family and friends can experience shock, anger, guilt, and depression. The economic toll of suicide on society is immense as well. Suicides and suicide attempts cost the nation almost $70 billion per year in lifetime medical and work loss costs alone. People who attempt suicide and survive may experience serious injuries such as broken bones or brain injury. These injuries can have long-term effects on their health. People who survive suicide attempts may also experience depression and other mental health problems. Many other people are impacted by knowing someone who dies or by personally experiencing suicidal thoughts. Additionally, being a survivor or someone who lived experience or someone with lived experience increases one's risk of suicide. Okay, now on to the public health news and research roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, lifestyle, not genetics, explains most premature heart disease from Science Daily. Five modifiable risk factors were assessed: physical inactivity, smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, and high cholesterol. Nearly three-quarters of patients had at least three of these risk factors compared to 31% of controls. In both groups, the likelihood of developing cardiovascular disease increased exponentially with each additional risk factor. The probability of cardiovascular disease was 3, 7, and 24 times higher with 1, 2, or 3 or more risk factors, respectively. I just wanted to highlight this briefly just to talk about in health problems, the risks are way more than additive. And this example is with heart disease. If you have two risk factors, you're seven times more likely than somebody with no risk factors. And if you have three or more of these risk factors, you're 24 times more likely to have cardiovascular disease. So, you know, if you just have one, well, it's a risk. But when you have two or three, the risks go up exponentially. Okay, and the next story, which also relates to additive risks, flu vaccination linked with lower risk of early death in patients with high blood pressure. Influenza vaccination in patients with high blood pressure is associated with an 18% reduced risk of death during flu season. According to previous research, the stress flu injection puts on the body may trigger heart attacks and strokes. Patients with high blood pressure are at raised risk of heart attack and stroke. By stopping flu infection, vaccination could also protect against cardiovascular events, but until now, this had not been investigated. After adjusting for patient differences, in a given flu season, vaccination was associated with an 18% relative reduction in the risk of dying from all cause, a 16% relative reduction in the risk of dying from any cardiovascular disease, and a 10% relative reduction in the risk of dying from heart attack or stroke. We show that influenza vaccination may improve cardiovascular outcomes in patients with hypertension. During the nine flu seasons we studied, vaccine coverage ranged from 26 to 36%, meaning that many patients with high blood pressure were not vaccinated. If you have high blood pressure, it would be worth discussing vaccination with your doctor. Regarding how flu and cardiovascular disease might be connected, when the influenza virus infects the body, it triggers a strong immune reaction and subsequent inflammation. These responses fight the infection and clear the virus from the body, but may increase the risk of having a heart attack or stroke. Heart attacks and strokes are caused by the rupture of atherosclerotic plaques in the arteries leading to the heart or the brain. After a rupture, a blood clot forms and cuts off the blood supply. It is thought that high levels of acute inflammation induced by influenza infection reduce the stability of plaques and may make them more likely to rupture. I wanted to cover this story partly because it has broader implications. One, this is for people with high blood pressure. Getting a flu vaccination can help out particularly to reduce your health risk. But also the fact that people that are vulnerable and some people that may not be able to take a flu vaccination and are particularly susceptible to consequences of getting the flu actually rely on the herd immunity, that is, people around them, other people in the community, to have the flu vaccination to help protect them. And this often is young children or older people with immune compromised or very serious complications of chronic disease. Okay, next up, changing pace a bit. This from Deadline Detroit. It matters that Detroit broke federal law when it razed an asbestos-laden building. It's time someone took demolition authority away from Detroit City Hall. Here's the latest. The Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy issued violations late last week to both the city's land bank and its building authority and a contractor for violating federal law. The state, which enforces federal hazardous air contamination laws, found the city failed to file proper papers before the Detroit contractor demolished an abandoned apartment building at 31 Woodland Street this year without removing the equivalent of 3 football fields of dangerous asbestos. The city of Detroit owned the North End property. It should also be noted that the city entered in December into a court-sanctioned judgment order to handle asbestos properly after it was discovered that the program in the past has not been taking care of the public's health. Just last month, the largest asbestos abatement contractor was suspended from doing business with the city after it was discovered he had financial ties to the company who was supposed to monitor his work. The news could not have come at a worse time for Mayor Mike Dugan, who is supposed to make his pitch to the city council and the poorest urban dwellers in America for a $200 million bond to raise more money for a demolition after squandering $250 million in federal money. Residents near the site of the asbestos bomb at Woodward and Woodland, a place of low money and rooms let by the hour, are not impressed. The government, man, they're crooked, said Greg Charlson, 42, who lives in a red brick colonial just south of the site. This whole block was covered in that S-word. Just goes to show downtown don't care nothing about us, and you wonder why people are so angry, why nobody's got trust. Okay, and moving on to other trustworthy sources, this in the New York Times, Juul illegally marketed e-cigarettes, the FDA says. Juul Labs, the dominant e-cigarette company, illegally marketed its vaping products as a less harmful alternative to traditional cigarettes, the FDA said on Monday, casting a deepening shadow over the safety of e-cigarette devices. The agency issued a warning letter to Juul, saying that the company violated federal regulations because it had not received federal approval to promote and sell its vaping products as a healthier option. The FDA's action dealt a setback to the company's effort to rebrand itself after public outrage erupted over a surge in teenage vaping. And it served as a reminder that the health effects of e-cigarettes are not established at a time when more than 400 people have been sickened by vaping-related illnesses. 5 deaths have been linked to vaping, and hundreds of people have been hospitalized. Public health investigators have yet to determine a specific cause, but they have cited the use of cannabis and nicotine vaping products as possibilities. No one product or company has been implicated. Regardless of where products like e-cigarettes fall in the continuum of tobacco product risk, the law is clear that before marketing tobacco products for reduced risk, companies must demonstrate with scientific evidence that their specific product does in fact pose less risk or is less harmful, said Dr. Ned Sharpless, the acting FDA commissioner. Juul has ignored the law and, very concerningly, has made some of these statements in school to our nation's youth. The high levels of nicotine in Juul's products are of particular concern for their effects on the still-developing brains of a generation of teenagers and as a potential gateway drug that could reverse decades of a steep decline in smoking rates. Juul has engendered further criticism by selling 35% of the company to Altria, one of the leading cigarette companies. the union-fueled criticism that Juul ultimately cared about profits at the expense of public health, an assertion Juul denied. Altria and Philip Morris International are now in merger talks, which could give Juul extraordinary pipelines to overseas markets. The growing popularity of e-cigarettes has been paralleled by an evolving and unfinished regulatory framework. The core question facing regulators and public health experts has been whether the potential benefits of the new technology, such as the possibility that it can reduce smoking-related deaths, will outweigh risk, like those posed to youths. Next up, moving to healthcare issues. This from the Center for Health Journalism. If Ohio can't pass the simplest price transparency laws, how will Congress curb surprise bills? If what happened in Ohio this summer is any clue, it's going to be a tough slog to pass congressional legislation regulating those surprise medical bills that have been heaped on Americans in recent years. And it may be just as hard to enact even the simplest of disclosure laws letting patients in on how much their health care really costs. In mid-July, Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican, vetoed several health care bills, including one that would have required health care providers to notify patients, insurance companies within 24 hours of scheduling a procedure and disclose what the service would cost. The insurer would then automatically give patients an estimate of those costs. The bill sponsor, Jim Butler, Speaker pro tempore of the Ohio House of Representatives, said patients would not have to ask for the price information. Requiring people to ask isn't a good strategy, he argued, since most people don't do that. He cited a 2012 Massachusetts law that required hospitals to disclose to patients within 2 business days the amount their insurer would pay for a procedure, but only if patients asked. As it turns out, very few people did. In his veto message, DeWine said his rejection of these laws was in the public interest because the federal government has already begun to address the problem, and it was important that the state not put, quote, duplicative or burdensome regulations on healthcare providers. All this sounds like thin cover for killing state legislation that Ohio's healthcare industry, especially the hospitals, had mightily opposed. As Butler's law was being debated, the Ohio Hospital Association issued its own justification for opposing these laws, insisting that hospitals, quote, wish to empower patients to fully understand cost obligations and quite aside from any law or regulation, are providing more information to patients. The statement added that meaningful information needed to be written in a way hospitals and other providers can comply with the law. Yeah, they're saying they're already doing it. Okay. For Butler, it was his second defeat on price transparency. He had sponsored a transparency law in 2015 that would have required hospitals and other providers to give patients a cost estimate no later than the same day a procedure or medical intervention took place. The hospitals objected and healthcare providers sued to prevent the law from taking effect. That suit is still in the Ohio courts, and Butler expects the state Supreme Court will have the last word. Butler's 0-2 record here is emblematic of how hard the medical establishment will fight to prevent even the simplest consumer price disclosure laws from reaching the public. They offer a cautionary tale for what might happen this fall to federal surprise bill legislation and other efforts to make healthcare prices more transparent and open to patient scrutiny. I asked Butler what the hospital industry is really afraid of and why they are fighting so hard to maintain the status quo. His answer was simple. Hospitals don't want transparency because it will create competition. If Hospital A offers gallbladder surgery at a lower price than Hospital B, patients might choose Hospital A, and Hospital B could lose business. As it stands right now, Hospital A may well be cheaper than Hospital B, but patients have no easy way of knowing that. And with patients assuming higher out-of-pocket expenses through larger deductibles and larger co-insurance obligations, these price differences are not trivial and can throw a family budget way out of whack. These days, hospitals have become big businesses with profit maximization a major objective. As Axios's Bob Herman continually points out, these profits are fueled by dwindling competition as hospitals continue to consolidate into larger health systems. A recent study by United Health Group, the insurance giant, found that hospital prices for inpatient care increased 19% and physician prices by 10% between 2013 and 2017. No wonder price secrecy is a calculated strategy, said Gene Pinder, founder of Clear Health Costs, a digital startup that works with news outlets to disclose the cost of medical care. All that money collected from overpriced care and mysterious bills go into lobbying and behind-the-scenes pressure. They lobby lawmakers and regulators to protect the current system and to skew it even further to their benefit. Legislative fixes to the problem of surprise billing have proven especially tough, despite widespread journalistic efforts to bring this to public attention, especially by Kaiser Health News and Vox's Sarah Cliff, now at the New York Times. Furthermore, JAMA Internal Medicine has just reported the number of surprise bills for emergency and inpatient services going up, even at in-network hospitals that employ out-of-network physicians. The size of those bills is increasing, too. The top 10% of inpatient visits cost more than $3,000. As Congress returns to take up the issue of surprise medical bills, legislators face a highly motivated phalanx of lobbyists for doctors, hospitals, insurance carriers, and air ambulance companies that have turned surprise billing into a lucrative business model. Changes that would give patients more financial protection face an uncertain future. One obvious reason these groups are so opposed to such legislation is that they stand to lose money if they can't bill out-of-network rates in these cases. But there's a larger issue as well. At the crux of the dispute in Congress is a larger fear of anything resembling rate setting, aka government-set price controls, on medical services, which are part of most other nations' health systems and what makes it possible for them to provide health care to everyone at a reasonable price tag. Healthcare industry stakeholders with deep pockets don't want surprise billing legislation to open the door for more stringent price controls later on. As I've often argued, mere disclosure of prices isn't likely to lower the price of individual procedures or the overall cost of medical services in the U.S. Serious cost containment through federally regulated prices, the kind the mighty industry groups are fighting against, will have to do that. Still, patients are being asked to shoulder more and more of the costs of their care and need help now, and that's what Representative Butler was trying to bring to Ohioans. It's always possible Congress will dish up a surprise of its own and pass strong legislation fixing the mess of unexpected medical bills and require healthcare providers to be more candid about their prices. But the show of hospital strength to defeat essentially modest attempts at consumer protection in Ohio reinforces Pinder's argument that price secrecy is a profit strategy. Next time you hear healthcare businesses say they're all for transparency, take their comments with a grain of salt. Okay, and in a related story, next up from the Physicians for a National Health Program, healthcare will again be a top issue for Democratic presidential candidates. The candidates may agree on a goal of universal coverage, but some may argue that we don't need single-payer Medicare for all to get there. Sadly, both politicians and pundits are susceptible to what might call corporate talking point-itis. Corporate talking point-itis's main symptoms include the irresistible urge to spout health insurance industry talking points against Medicare for all, along with a painful and awkward defense of our broken healthcare system. When watching politicians, pundits, or policy experts discuss Medicare for all, keep this checklist of cardinal signs and symptoms of corporate talking point-itis handy. If they utter one or more of these phrases, you can be certain they are infected. Government-run healthcare, socialized medicine, build on what's working, fix what's broken, Canadian wait times, middle-class tax hike, free market solutions, abolish, ban, or take away your private insurance, start over from scratch, disruptive, choice and competition, strengthen, protect, or build on the ACA, and one-size-fits-all health plan. Okay, I'd like to comment a little bit on each one of those. Okay, government-run healthcare. First of all, most healthcare is covered by the federal government in this country, and that's because of Medicare and Medicaid, particularly Medicare, which covers the elderly population, which has most of the healthcare needs in the country. So actually, a minority of healthcare is actually funded through private insurance. Okay, socialized medicine. Well, except for the military and the Veterans Administration, American healthcare is distinctly privatized in delivery. And this is also one of the reasons for the profit motive being so prominent. Build on what's working, fix what's broken. Well, First of all, you've got three different segments, the government, the private health insurance, and the uninsured. Clearly isn't working for the uninsured, and it seems that free market solutions don't really seem to work for that. And it's actually the private health insurance companies where most of the cost is out of control. And like the previous story, you've got like a lack of transparency. People don't even know what they're buying. Okay, Canadian wait times. Well, does the U.S. have better access than Canada? No, that's a simple answer there. Middle class tax hike. Well, this is true that you would shift from premiums, copays, deductibles, uncovered out-of-pocket expenses, particularly for like dental and vision, to tax-funded coverage of these, but you'd also significantly reduce the overall cost while expanding coverage to everyone. So yes, there would be a tax hike, but you'd actually be paying less money and getting more for it. Free market solutions. Well, like the previous story I just covered, we don't actually know what the price of something is, so it's very hard to like to drive competition. And also, even if we knew the price, in many places, particularly rural areas, there's little or no choice of providers anyways. Okay, abolish, ban, or take away your private insurance. Well, again, this is a sector and the profit motive within healthcare that is providing most of the perverse incentives where things aren't working. Start over from scratch. Well, expanding Medicare, which has been around for over 50 years with a lot of experience, is hardly starting over from scratch. The next one, disruptive, well, that's true in the sense that it would be a large change, but this disruption is mostly to for-profit healthcare, the poison in our system. Choice and competition. Well, with universal Medicare for All coverage, you could go to any provider. There would be no out-of-work providers anymore, so choice and competition becomes kind of moot. I mean, you have free choice, so go anywhere. You can't do that now. Strengthen, protect, or build on the ACA. Well, we've learned that this patchwork and incremental measures have not gotten a handle on costs or access to quality coverage. Maybe we need to try something a little more comprehensive. Well, then that relates to the last one, the one-size-fits-all health plan. Well, if covering all medically necessary health care from cradle to grave, including vision and dental for those who still have eyes and teeth, yeah, that's one size fits all. And the Physicians for a National Health Program closed by saying, as healthcare providers, we know that even patients with private insurance can face financial ruin due to denials, out-of-network bills, and the skyrocketing costs of copays and deductibles. Enough is enough. Only single-payer Medicare for All, not a public option or improving the ACA, will solve our nation's healthcare crisis.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
And next up, if you were wondering who's paying for what in our society, here's a story that'll shed a little bit of light for part of that from Science Daily. Only a fraction of the costs of excessive drinking are paid for by alcohol taxes. The total harm caused by excessive alcohol consumption is a staggering $2.05 per drink in the United States. And of this, the government ends up paying about 80 cents per drink. However, the federal government and states only bring in about 21 cents per drink on average in alcohol taxes, according to new research in the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs. This leaves the majority of the cost of alcohol's harms borne by those who don't drink excessively or who don't drink at all. The disparity between alcohol-related cost to government and alcohol taxes amounts to a large taxpayer-funded subsidy of excessive drinking and alcohol companies. Research shows that higher prices on alcohol, often through increased taxes, can lead to less excessive consumption, which in turn reduces a range of alcohol-related harms such as violence, motor vehicle injuries, and liver cirrhosis. Increasing alcohol taxes could improve public health and reduce the disparity between alcohol-related costs and alcohol taxes in states. Policy debates around alcohol taxes have mostly centered on public health benefits, but I think our study might change the focus of the debate somewhat, since it seems fair that those who drink the most and who produce and sell alcohol should cover the cost to society, says study lead author Jason Blanchett of the Boston University School of Public Health. State and federal specific excise taxes are based on the volume of alcohol sold, not the price, and therefore can erode over time because of inflation. During the past 25 years, state excise taxes have declined by more than 30% on average in inflation-adjusted terms. The federal excise taxes have declined by almost 50% because they were last adjusted for inflation in 1991. The bottom line is that current alcohol taxes, even considering all types of tax, including general sales tax, don't come close to covering alcohol-related costs. So for the alcohol industry, this is what you call externalizing the cost of your business, the mayhem that's wreaked by excessive alcohol consumption in an industry where most of the alcohol that's consumed in this country is consumed abusively, meaning five or more drinks at one setting for a man or four or more drinks at one setting for a woman. Okay, well, let's try to end on some good news today. This from Stat News. Stat wins long legal fight as Kentucky Supreme Court clears way for release of Purdue OxyContin files. After a 3.5-year legal battle, secret records about Purdue Pharma's marketing of its potent opioid painkiller OxyContin will finally be made public. The Kentucky Supreme Court denied a request from Purdue to review lower court's decisions to release the documents. The decision is a major victory for Stat, which first filed a motion to unseal the records in March of 2016. Purdue has fought to keep the documents out of view, but the Supreme Court's refusal is final and can't be appealed. Now the public stands to get a glimpse of new information about how Purdue promoted OxyContin and what executives knew about the risk of addiction that came with the drug. The company's aggressive marketing of OxyContin has been blamed by some analysts for helping trigger an opioid addiction epidemic. Overdoses related to prescription opioids have claimed 200,000 lives in the last two decades, and there are now nearly 100 opioid deaths every day in the U.S., many from heroin and the synthetic opioid fentanyl. The case against Purdue was one of our first decisions when we launched Stat, and we're thrilled that the trove of documents will finally be made public, said John Henry, the owner and publisher of Stat. As the opioid crisis continues to devastate communities across the country, it is vital that we have more answers to so many outstanding questions about the genesis of the epidemic and Purdue's aggressive marketing of OxyContin. The records in the sealed files also include emails and other company documents about marketing strategies, internal reports on clinical trials, information about how sales representatives hawked OxyContin, and communications about earlier legal cases. Companies like Purdue Pharma should not be allowed as part of any settlement to simply seal information that could be embarrassing to them as a company and shed light on less than savory activities, said John Fleischaker, a Louisville, Kentucky attorney who represented Stat in the case. It's time to open it all up. The public scrutiny of Purdue and the Sackler family has grown in the 41 months since Stat first sought to unseal the records. Along with wholesalers, pharmacies, and other opioid makers, Purdue is a defendant in some 2,000 lawsuits from states, tribes, and local governments alleging that the companies unleashed and profited from the opioid crisis. Most of the suits have been bundled together in a federal case in Ohio. We are the heart of it all, my friends. Okay, well, that ends it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to re-listen to this show or any previous show or queue up future shows, then you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.